Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and those who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. This is Season 2, sponsored by Park Road Books, the oldest and only independent bookstore in Charlotte. I don't know about you, but I get a good feeling when I'm surrounded by a world of new books, and an even better feeling when I know I'm supporting the local independent bookstore. Consider stopping by Park Road Books for your feel-good experience. You'll meet a friendly staff ready to recommend that next great read, just for you. Speaking of feeling good, I've got a good feeling that you will enjoy our guest author today. So let's get to it. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. In this episode, author Nora Gaskin reads from her true crime book about a murder in Chapel Hill in the 1960s, and then jumps to readings from her novel, The Worst Thing. With Nora's help and the characters from The Worst Thing, we dive headfirst into the realm of suspense, where there is no mystery about who is the deranged perpetrator, just plenty of angst about how things are going to turn out. Nora's not only an author, but an editor, so she understands how to shape a story. She starts first with a reading from Time of Death.
December 24th, 1963, 8:45 a.m. Stanley Forte pulled up in front of friend Frank Rinaldi's house and honked the car horn. Frank came out and got in. "Together again, baby," Frank said, and they set off, driving the 12 miles or so from Chapel Hill to Durham, North Carolina, to go Christmas shopping. They bought gifts for their wives, toys for Stan's two sons, and Frank bought a teddy bear for the baby his wife Lucille was carrying. When they returned to Frank's duplex apartment, 105 North Street in Chapel Hill, at about 1:30 p.m., they found that Lucille had been struck on the head, gagged, strangled, and suffocated. She and her baby were both dead. By 6 p.m., Frank was in jail, charged with murder. Thus began an ordeal that lasted for 2 years and a lifetime. Frank would be tried twice for the crime of murder. He was convicted in the first trial and spent a year in prison, held in seclusion on death row, although he had not been sentenced to death. It was deemed to be for his safety. Frank was supported by a number of friends, including my father, James Gaskin. Dad was a professor in the English department at the University of North Carolina, and he held a position in the graduate school that made him an advisor to graduate students. In both of those positions, he would have had a chance to know Frank. I have no reason to believe he was friendlier or closer to Frank than to other students until Lucille died and Frank was arrested. My father always believed in Frank's innocence, and so did my mother, my sister, my brother, and I. I was 12, almost 13, in December 1963, and for the next 2 years, my family life was led against the backdrop of the Rinaldi case. Dad was actively involved in supporting Frank, even visiting him as often as possible during the year he was in Central Prison. My mother kept clippings from newspapers that covered the case. After both she and my dad died, I found the file and brought it home. I didn't read the clippings for quite a while because I was afraid to. As a grown-up, I know that pregnant women who get murdered are most often murdered by the fathers of their babies, and I know how rare a random murder is. My dad never wavered on the question of Frank's innocence. I know that because I spoke with him about it late in his life. I feared that I would read the clippings and find doubt in my own mind. It wasn't doubt about Frank's innocence that worried me. It was doubt about my father's judgment. I need not have feared. When I did read the clippings, not once but a number of times, I found that my own belief in Frank's innocence grew stronger and stronger. So did my desire to understand why he was arrested so quickly, why no real unbiased investigation took place, and why an innocent man who was the victim of a terrible crime and not the perpetrator was convicted. I believe that the case held up a mirror for my small and idealized hometown that found itself invaded by the larger world in the early and mid-1960s. The reflection wasn't pretty, but it has been compelling for me.
In addition to The Worst Thing, Nora Gaskin is the author of two previous books, Time of Death, The True Tale of a Quest for Justice in 1960s Chapel Hill, and a mystery based on a true crime, Until Proven, a A Mystery in Two Parts. As the founder, editor, and publisher of Leister Books, Nora has stewarded more than 20 books into publication. She's also edited the byline for Carolina Crimes, 21 Tales of Need, Greed, and Dirty Deeds, an anthology of stories set in North Carolina and South Carolina, with an introduction by Jeffrey Deaver, published in 2017 by Down and Out Books. Nora traveled to visit with us from her home in Chapel Hill, along the Piedmont back roads, with its woods and curves that often kept her from seeing what's ahead. She says of Piedmont, North Carolina, it's the perfect place for a mystery suspense writer to live. Nora, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Landis. I'm delighted to be here.
This segment that you read from your first book, Time of Death, which you call a true tale of a quest for justice in 1960s Chapel Hill, that was a time in the life of Chapel Hill that's much different than it is today.
Yes, indeed.
Small town. I mean, it's always been a small town, but even smaller then, right?
Very small, yes.
And you grew up there?
I grew up there. Yeah. My dad was on the faculty.
Yeah, and I think I get a hint as I listen to you read this account of what compelled you, but apart from what's on the written page here, this really took hold of you. You wanted to write about this.
Yeah. I wanted to write about it for a long time. I have very clear memories of some of the things that went on during the time. I have very clear memories of my father coming home from attending every minute of both trials, exhausted, and telling us about what had gone on. I have clear memories of him talking about it in the immediate aftermath when events were still fresh in his mind, especially after the first trial when Frank was convicted and my father was deeply, deeply disappointed, I think surprised. And I think just if Frank was tried by a jury of his peers, they were also my father's peers in a lot of ways. And I think he was very disappointed that they could come to this conclusion.
And you were an adolescent, you said 12, almost 13
right,
at that time.
Right.
And a lot of changes going on for you in your life at the time. And yet you're sort of drawn into this murder mystery that your family has some connection to because your father knew him.
Yeah. Yes, knew him and was very active in helping to recruit between the first trial and the second trial. My father helped to recruit an old head lawyer, a very experienced mm-hmm. criminal trial lawyer, as opposed to the two young men who were the defense attorneys in the first trial.
And when I read Time of Death, excuse me, but I noticed that in that first trial, there was a lot of you almost get this vision of To Kill a Mockingbird. Like, this isn't fair. You know, what's going on
here? It wasn't fair.
The deck was stacked, and you had a sort of turncoat witness, so to speak, who a little flamboyant, wanting to put the blame on the defendant. You got a question about whether they were out shopping during the time of the murder. So you had that issue. But then there was another issue that really struck me, which resulted in the new trial. The issue of homosexuality invaded
right.
that first trial.
It did.
Yeah, talk about that a second.
I'm pretty sure that I was not aware of homosexuality as a word or a concept before that trial got started. And I think it's to my parents' credit that they didn't try to shield their children from anything that was going on in it. And the trial was covered very heavily by the local newspapers. One of the people who reported on that first trial told me in a brief phone conversation as I was working on the book that the Chapel Hill Weekly allowed them to publish what amounted to a full transcript. It was just extensive coverage of the trials.
Like Court TV back in the early 60s.
Like Court TV in the Chapel Hill Weekly. And I read all of that at the time, so my parents were not trying to protect us from anything that was going on. If the concept of homosexuality was new to me, I think I understood, and I certainly do now, that it was a dirty trick that the
because it had
prosecution,
nothing,
it
had
it
nothing,
had nothing to do.
Right, so they tried to use the idea that Frank was homosexual.
Right.
To get the jury inflamed and prejudiced.
Exactly,
against him.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was all by innuendo. There was no evidence presented.
Like a friend, a male friend wrote him a letter, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or He hung out with guys.
And, yeah. And he said that quote that I read in the very first bit, "Together again, baby," by Frank's own statement, that's what he said when he got in the car with his male friend that morning to go Christmas shopping for their wives. And the district attorney turned that into a suggestion of something that he felt the jury would not approve of and be prudish about as a thing that he could use against Frank. And then by the second trial, the defense was quoting baseball players from the World Series winning team that year who called each other baby and slapped each other on the butt. So eventually the defense was able to counteract some of that. And as you suggested, the appeals court found that was grounds for overturning the first trial.
The Supreme Court of North Carolina found that he should not have been allowed, that homosexuality should not have been allowed to become an issue. And since that one issue was enough, the court did not comment on the other errors on appeal. And he went back and had another trial, and this time
acquitted.
And there were people on both sides of the opinion scale here as to whether he was guilty or innocent?
That's correct.
What happened to him? Whatever happened to him?
He went on to finish his PhD at the University of Massachusetts. He then, so far as I know, spent his whole career in academics at a small college in Connecticut, and he lived with his parents in the house that he'd grown up in until both of his parents died, and then he himself died.
You have this comment toward the end of the book about the concept of justice and being a lawyer. I'm interested in that concept from a legal standpoint, but you said here, whenever I hear that justice is for the victim of a crime, I say no. Justice must be for the accused. And then you say if it isn't, then any of us could go through Frank Rinaldi's ordeal.
That's what I believe.
Yeah, and you came to that by going through all these clippings and reading these transcripts.
Right.
But a lot of the focus sometimes is on, you know, winning the case to bring closure for the family. Because none of what happened here with the guilty verdict or the not guilty verdict is going to bring back the woman that's part of the family that lost her.
Right.
And then you say, if we dare think it cannot happen here, we set ourselves up to make a terrible mistake and to do it with that most human of creations, the airtight rationalization. Too many innocents go to prison for no better reason than that. All right, so true crime in Chapel Hill.
True crime in Chapel Hill.
Now, you didn't continue to be a true crime writer. This story took hold of you, but you did take this experience of going back and writing about this trial to write your first novel, Until Proven. We're going to be talking about several of your books today. The Worst Thing, which is the most recent book that came out. Different genre than Until Proven. Until Proven's more of a mystery, right?
Correct.
And then you went to suspense, and we'll talk about that shift in a minute. But talk about Until Proven for just a moment. It's got a little uniqueness to it because you've got this sort of murder mysteries in two different time periods, right?
Yes. Yes, in Until Proven, there are two murders. They happen 40 years apart. And they involve the same two large extended families that overlap, not only in the original murder, but 40 years later, the later generations of each of those families are also overlapping, know each other, are involved with each other. And the first murder that happens in Until Proven is, at least in my mind, based on the Rinaldi trial, the first trial. Where
so
he
you use that for inspiration?
It for inspiration. Now, I made some key changes. For instance, one of the points that I make in Time of Death is that Frank and Lucille were both outsiders. They were from Connecticut, which meant they were Yankees Chapel Hill. And Chapel Hill is itself a place where a lot of people are transient. They come, they go to school, they leave. But still, in Chapel Hill, there's a core of old-timers. I would be one of them, families that have been there a long time. Mm-hmm. So Frank and Lucille were really outsiders. Until Proven, the family that suffers the loss, the death of a family member, and then the husband who is charged with that murder, they're both very much insiders. They are part of an old and well-established family in a fictional community that I call Piedmont, North Carolina. So some things like that I fictionalized for the sake of the story, but working out that the first half of the book, that first murder, that was very much me working out my questions that still remained decades later about time of death, about Chapel Hill, about how this happened. And I got to do a little therapy on myself by writing the fictionalized version. Then I didn't have enough material there. I discovered it wasn't long enough to make a full book. So I thought, well, how do I round this out? How do I get a book length creation out of this? And I decided pretty quickly, well, there would have to be a second murder. The only way The only way you can balance the impact of that first murder on both family and community is to have an equally weighty event happen later on. So that had to be the second murder. And I made it 40 years later so that I could explore what things had changed in that community and what things perhaps remained the same.
Well, Nora, in your bio, you talk about the fact that you love living in the Piedmont because of the landscape with its hills, woods, and curves that keep viewers from seeing what's ahead, because it's a perfect place for a mystery suspense writer to live.
I think so.
I'd never thought about that exactly. You know, what's around that next corner? You know, can we solve this mystery? So what drew you to writing mystery? Was it this experience? Was it trying to figure out?
That experience had a lot to do with it, but I will say something drew me to mystery stories earlier than that. Mm-hmm. The earliest book I can remember reading for myself repeatedly when I was a kid was a book called Mystery of Alpine Castle. I have no idea who wrote it. I have no real memory of it other than the title. But I know it was
just
a book
a great,
I read.
Great title.
Great title. And I read it more than once when I was a child and could read for myself. My mother had a book on her bookcase called Who Killed Aunt Maggie? And again, I don't remember who wrote it. It was
Uncle Jeff.
Exactly. Or in the drawing room with the wrench.
Right.
It was that kind of a house party murder mystery, similar to Agatha Christie. And I read that book a number of times when I was a kid, and it was probably a little over my head, but it was there, and I read it. And again, it was something about the whole concept of mystery drew me early on, and then I was really hooked with the need to explore, the need I felt to explore what happened in Chapel Hill on Christmas Eve in 1963 and the next 2 years that followed. And I hoped eventually to write a mystery. I also for a long time thought I couldn't plot one. I wasn't at all sure I could do it. I wasn't sure I could plot it. And then finally, things just came together for me to write the fictionalized version of the time of death story.
And now you've got a criminal record. You're a sister in crime, right?
That's right. I'm a sister in crime.
Yeah, explain what that means.
Sure. Sisters in Crime is a national organization for people who both read and write crime fiction, suspense, mystery, all the things, all the subgenres under that heading. And if anyone listening to this podcast is either a writer of or a reader of that kind of fiction, they should take a look at the website for Sisters in Crime and maybe join the national organization. They have a great newsletter. You find out about books. You find out about controversy that's going on in the writing community. You find out about writers who are touring will be making appearances. And then if you happen to have a local chapter nearby, join their great programs, typically once a month. It's well worth your time if you either read or write the stuff.
Well, great. Well, now we're going to shift to suspense, a little bit different approach to writing. You know who did it, or you know who's going to do it.
Exactly.
But you don't know how exactly it's going to turn out.
Right.
And you keep ratcheting up the tension, right?
I hope so.
So the name of your new book, which is a suspense novel, is called?
The Worst Thing.
The Worst Thing. We're going to do a couple of sections here, but I'm going to have you read first this section that I'll sort of called The Disappearance. We bring the detectives in, and they're doing a little investigation. So I'm have you read that section, and then we'll talk some more.
Great. Nash, you're with me. Detective Genevieve Nash looked up. Detective Brendan Quick spoke as he passed her desk on his way to the door. She closed her laptop, grabbed her jacket, and stood up in one motion. She checked the clock. 10:45 p.m. What have we got? She followed him down the stairs, no waiting for the elevator. Missing person. Their footsteps echoed against concrete walls until they reached the garage, a floor below street level. Quick clicked the car doors open. Do you know who Angel is? I guess her real name's Angie Boone, he asked. Nash slid into the passenger seat. Sure. Is she the missing person? Her roommate called it in. Where are we going? She asked. Parkside. A high-priced neighborhood, not far from the station. Jen had transferred to the precinct less than 24 hours earlier. She knew two things about Quick. As the captain's admin had whispered, he was too good-looking to be a cop. Nash saw dark hair, blue eyes, cheekbones, sharp jawline, but they had no impact on her. Not her type. The other thing Nash knew about him was that he was a good detective. Smart. A golden boy. Whatever the reason for her being on this call, it needed to go well. They drove another two blocks and a car pulled out of an on-street parking space ahead of them. Our lucky night, Quick said. That's the building. It was the kind of street Nash would love to live on, as if she could ever afford it. Human-scale buildings, no high-rise, just a block from the park. They parked, got out of the car, and crossed the street. Is this where you'd expect a hot young model to live? Quick asked. This is too old money, isn't it? He pressed a call button. Who is it? A man's voice came through the speaker. Detectives Quick and Nash. The door unlocked with a subdued buzz. The elevator was a replica of an old one, with exposed gears and cables and a cage door, but Nash saw that the electronics were new. The car rose fast. When they landed on the fifth floor, the door opened into a foyer rather than a hallway. The entire floor must be one large apartment. A man stood there, waiting for them. He was substantial and paunchy in a way that made her think he was an athlete grown into late middle age. What hair he had left was clipped short. I'm Mike Michaels, he said. ID? Michaels' tone was a bit aggressive. Nash had seen it before. The shift of blame for needing to have cops in the house to the cops themselves. Quick was calm, matter of fact, not answering in kind. He let the men study their badges and asked, How do you relate to this missing person, Mr. Michaels? The man's eyebrows rose. Me? I'm the building manager, and I look after the girls, Kella and Angie. Kella Mace? I spoke with her on the phone. She's waiting on you. Michael stepped aside, and they moved forward through a wide arched doorway. The apartment opened out in front of them. Quick had asked, and now Jen answered to herself. No, it did not look like someplace a hot young model would live. Michaels led them through to another room, a smaller one, much more lived in. A young woman sat in a large upholstered chair that faced the door, her legs curled under her. Her eyes were large and dark under deep bangs. These are the detectives, girlie. Michaels went to her side and took up a guardian's post. Miss Mace? Quick crossed the room and offered his hand. I'm Detective Quick. Thanks for coming so fast. She changed her position so that she sat upright, feet on the floor. She wore loose-fitting clothes that made her look even smaller than she was. Nash saw outward fragility, but she felt her antennae rise, too. The posture, the clothing, the impression they gave, they were not accidental. She glanced at Quick, wondered what he thought. There was a second chair beside Kella's, and Mike Michaels took it. That left the love seat for the two detectives to share. Nash felt Quick's brief hesitation, then they both sat. Let's begin at the beginning, Ms. Mace, Quick said. I understand the missing woman is your roommate. We both live here. Kella's voice was low but clear. We don't share a room. Are both of your names on the lease? I own the apartment. How long have you known Ms. Boone, and how long has she lived here? Mike Michaels interrupted. Hey, Quick, you're wasting time. What about the freaking weirdo she told you about on the phone? Mike. Kella held up a hand to quiet him. She leaned toward Quick to answer his last question. We met in high school, Kella said, a boarding school. After we graduated, I came home to go to college, and she moved in with me. She wanted to be a model. She smiled and shrugged as if to say, "We all know what happened next." "When did you last see her?" Quick asked. "This afternoon, at about 2, a little before. We went to brunch at Lacey's Bistro in the next block. We ran into one of Angie's model friends, Vonnie, and her boyfriend, Andrew, I think. They invited us to a party tonight, and Angie said we would go. After we ate, she left to go to the gym. I went to the library and came home a few hours later. She never came." "How would you describe her mood?" Kella blinked and looked down. "I told her I didn't want to go to Vonnie's party. Angie thinks I should be more social, so she was a little angry with me when she left." "Could Angie have gone to the party alone and didn't tell you?" "Not straight from the gym. She didn't have clothes with her," Kella said, "or makeup. She'd have come home first. I found Vonnie's number and called her several times at the party. Angie wasn't ever there." "Angie's a reliable girl," Mike said. "She's not like a lot of them, saying one thing and doing another." Nash wondered how Quick added things up. Was this a girl who got in a snit with her friend and went to a party by herself? If so, she'd show up sometime before Monday, hungover and sorry. Nothing new there. Or was this a girl who needed to be found fast? "When did you begin to think Angie could be missing?" she asked. "I knew it when she wasn't home by 7, even if she did intend to go out later. I started calling her cell, and it went to voicemail every time." "Do you mind if I look at your phone?" Quick asked. She reached into a pocket and produced it. Quick scrolled through the call records. Nash wished she knew how to read him. She followed the threads of energy in the room. While he focused on the phone, Kella focused on him. "Miss Mace," Quick said, "when you called in, you said something about a stalker. What evidence do you have of that?" "The freaking weirdo," Mike said. "Like I said." When Kella began to speak, it was as if she'd been waiting for her turn. "I went with her to a photo shoot about 6 weeks ago. It was in an old industrial building, a warehouse or something, outside the city, across the river. I'd been to shoots before, but this one was bigger and more complicated. It's going to be huge for Angie's career, very high fashion. She'll have the magazine cover and a feature article." Kella went on to tell them that it had been mid-morning when she noticed this man watching Angie, and that he was one of the workmen who moved furniture around for the different scenes. When the other guys weren't needed, they went outside and hung around the catering truck, but he was always near Angie. "I know, because I was too," she said. "He tracked her, and I tracked him. Angie's big moment came at the end of the day. She came out wearing a dress with a huge skirt. It was white with gold and silver beads. She passed by me and whispered, 'This thing weighs a ton.' She made a face. Once she got by me, the guy stepped right in front of me. I'm pretty sure he snapped a photo or two of her with his cell phone." "Did he approach her at all?" Quick asked. "Not that I saw. I told her he was watching her, but she blew it off because it happens all the time. She can hardly walk down the street anymore." "Can you describe him?" "I took a picture of him." She reached for her phone, tapped the screen, and held it so that both Quick and Nash could see it. The back of a man's head, shaved and tattooed. Quick reached out and touched the screen to enlarge the image. "A gorilla?" he asked. "Look at its face," Kella said. "It's full of anger. It's evil. I heard someone call him ape." "So he was a creep that day," Quick said, "but that isn't stalking. Was there anything else?" "He showed up here," Mike said. "I was in the lobby and he banged on the door. He had a big bunch of roses, but I know all the delivery guys from the florists in the neighborhood and I'd never seen him before. He said they were for Angel, and he was supposed to deliver them in person. He asked which apartment was hers." "You didn't let him upstairs, did you?" Nash asked. "Are you kidding? I told him nobody here by that name. That's when he got belligerent. Said he knew she lives here, gave me a hard time, but he took his roses and left." "Did you tell Angie?" "No, but I told Kella, didn't I, girlie?" "I showed Mike the photo, but the man was wearing a cap pulled low and back, so he didn't see the tattoo. When I described him, Mike agreed. It had to have been him." "I don't understand why you didn't tell Angie," Nash said. "Why not warn her?" Mike answered, "Angie, she has a lot of guys who fall for her, and sometimes she thinks I'm too much the protective kind." "She says it's an occupational hazard," Kella said. "There have been men who tried too hard before, and she always handles it." "So why is it different this time?" Quick asked. "This time she's disappeared."
When we come back, we're going to find out more about the suspense novel, The Worst Thing, and the antagonist of the plot. Stay with us. Hey, listeners, a literary service announcement here. This time it's about another local podcast called Literary Latte. The host of the show is Linda Bouchard, founder of Booking Authors, Inc., a boutique public relations firm dedicated to authors. Linda is another Charlottean with a passion for bringing authors on a podcast. I met at the Charlotte Writers Club and connected immediately, and then I began listening to her show. Literary Latte is the podcast with a Southern accent on writing. Linda brings on publishing industry pros, best-selling Southern authors, and other writers with what she calls that Southern accent. She dives into the backstory, explores the writer's journey, and ends up with some teachable moments for writers. And it doesn't hurt that she's got a conversational style and a real-world knowledge of the publishing industry. I think you're going to like the show. You can find Literary Latte on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your podcast, and on our website, BookingAuthorsInc.com. Now back to some suspense writing with Nora Gaskin. Okay, we're back with Nora Gaskin, author of The Worst Thing. Nora, you set up what looks like it's an unhappy story to start here with this first reading. Is that what suspense is meant to do?
I think so, yes.
And this character, you've got the tattoo. Someone says they heard him called Ape. You're going to read in just a minute a little something that gives us not a visual, but more of an inside look at the mind of this antagonist. What I'd like to ask you is how an antagonist can be just as important, if not more important, to the plot of a book, particularly suspense, as the protagonist.
The suspense has to build. There's a concept that I've learned doing some reading about suspense fiction. This came from great suspense writer Patricia Highsmith, that you just have to keep piling on and piling on and piling on the obstacles that the hero has to overcome. All fiction involves overcoming obstacles, but suspense novels will just make those obstacles that much higher and build them up that much more. So you've got to have a pretty good antagonist. You've got to have a pretty good bad guy who will involve the reader as much as the good guys do, I hope, and give the reader a reason to keep going. How bad can this guy be? Oh my God, that's the worst thing. No, there could be something even worse than that. And that sort of building up of problems and building up of problems to be solved by the good guys is how you build suspense.
And the worst thing, the title, it has several layers. I've read the book. There's a layer that, I mean, you would think they were talking only about, you know, this kidnapping and this evildoer, so to speak. But there's another layer to it with one of the characters in the book. She loses her parents.
Yes.
Early on.
Yes.
And she thinks that is the worst thing.
Yes.
That could
yes.
ever happen. And you decided, well, let's kick that up a notch.
Let's kick it up a notch. And then let's kick it up another notch or two.
Right, right. Did you enjoy this transition from writing mystery to writing suspense?
I did once I made the transition. When I started out writing what became The Worst Thing, I had the character of Kella in mind first, and then I had the idea that she would have a very close friend who was murdered, and that was going to be Angie. And I was going to follow the time-tested formula with a dead body on page one.
I gotta have a dead body on page one.
Exactly.
Chalk marks around them on the sidewalk.
Exactly. Exactly. And we go from there. But I could never. I had that. I had Kella finding her friend murdered, and I had Kella then slumping down to sit against the wall in that room, and sort of break down. And then, of course, Kella was going to have to get up and go out and do something about this. And I could never get her out of that room. I just couldn't make the action happen after that. So it finally occurred to me that I was just trying to force a plot that wasn't there, that the story these two women were going to live through together as characters was something different. So I opened up my imagination and discovered what their real story was.
Which leads me to a question about the plot itself. This is sort of my 60 minutes question. You know, there's some criticism out there sometimes, whether it be movies or books or fictional accounts of women being stalked, women being subjugated, women being the objects of, you know, men
Yes.
Who were praying on them.
Yes.
And did that go through your mind? Do you have any thoughts about whether you're adding to that concept or whether or not by talking? Well, I'm going to let you explain what your thoughts are on that.
Sure. It did occur to me as I was writing the book. And ultimately, I did not want to be adding to that body of material. A word for what you're describing, a strong word for what you're describing is pornography, that it is a form of pornography to just treat a woman character as being dispensable, just the person who's going to be the recipient of some kind of violent action, and then is discarded, and the men go on to solve the crime. There's a lot of that. It's very old. It's a very old story among storytellers to put women in that position. And those were not the women I wanted to be writing about. But for fiction writers, when you create a character, you're in some ways you're creating, but in other ways you're discovering, as if that character already exists somehow, as a full-blown or fully formed entity, and it's your job as the writer to give that fully formed entity a life on the page. So there's a mix of creating the character as you go, but also figuring out who that character really is and not trying to force him or her into too much of a box.
So you're trying to, it is a complex question, you're trying to bring these characters to life and tell their story.
Right.
They're dealing with this very difficult circumstance.
Yes. So it was my hope and expectation that what I would discover is that it's the women who ultimately bring the bad guy down. One point, as I was getting close to the end of the book and trying to think, okay, how is this going to end? Because I'm not a plotter, I don't always know what comes next.
So, spoiler alert: the good guys win. Right?
The good guys win. Yeah. That I'm willing to go that far.
Okay.
And I was at that point of thinking, okay, how do we resolve this? How do we bring this bad guy down? And there were four people who individually or in combination were going to do it, and they were all four women. So I felt, okay, I have found the story of girl power. I have found where the women will ultimately prevail, and in the end it's one of them especially who prevails.
Okay, well let's dive into this corrupt, evil mind for just a moment. I'm going to have you read about Albert, otherwise known as Ape.
Albert went in the back door. Bitch Mom was in the living room with the TV on. Dr. Phil laying down the law to somebody. His dad had hated that guy. He yelled at the TV like the man could hear him, mocked the suits and ties, and fumed about how unfair the world was that this fat idiot got rich and famous. Maybe the IRS should check old Phil out. And all the time, Mom kept watching, kept cranking up the volume. Albert wondered why she still bothered, since she didn't have Dad there to aggravate anymore. It hurt Albert's head to think about all that. He went through the room without speaking and went upstairs. The sound of Dr. Phil's voice followed him. Do you want to know what I think? That was always the question, and hell no, Albert did not. He got to his room and closed the door before the doctor delivered his opinion. As loud as Phil's voice was, Dad's was just as loud in Albert's head. He's got the devil's own luck. That's what Dad said about people who had what he wanted. Mom had done laundry and dumped his clean clothes outside his door. He had finally gotten through to her he didn't want her in his room, ever. But did that mean she couldn't fold his stuff, couldn't put it down on a clean sheet to keep it off the floor as she never vacuumed? It made him mad, because he wanted to take a shower, the first thing he did after work, and she made him waste all this time. He folded each piece and put it away. Finally, he stripped off his work clothes. He got dirty working for the moving company, and he was sure the boss, Joe Biggers, gave him the filthiest jobs. Albert bundled the clothes he took off, and as he passed the stairs on his way to the bathroom, dropped them over the rail. Let her pick them up. He stood in front of the bathroom mirror. His scalp was sweaty from wearing a watch cap all day. That was Bigger's fault, too. He said he didn't want customers seeing the tattoo on the back of Albert's head. He peeled the cap off and felt his skin, stubbly. He put a new blade in his razor and shaved while he was in the shower. When his chin and cheeks were smooth enough, he ran the razor in an arc over his ear. When he was done, when he was satisfied he'd gotten every hair, he stepped out of the tub, washed the soap and dirt down the drain, then showered again. When he wiped the steam off the mirror, he liked what he saw. His skull glowed pink. He took the hand mirror and looked at the back of his head. He loved his tattoo. The big gorilla with fangs and rage. The guys at work called him Ape because of Darwin. Stupid guys. This tattoo was one big F.U. to them. He dressed and picked up the knife he liked to have in his pocket when he was home. A small one, just one blade so it folded slim, didn't take up space, but he felt its weight. It was the first knife he ever got when he was still a kid. He went downstairs. He had to step over the clothes he'd dropped. There was a cooking show on now, that woman who went to jail. She was maybe the person Dad hated most because she was still rich, still on TV. And Dad was where? Dead. Albert hoped if they had TV wherever Dad was now, it showed this woman's face 24/7. For God's sake, Mom said, cover that thing up. What she always said about his tattoo. She put her hand over her mouth, and he wasn't sure if she laughed or gagged. He tapped the knife in his pocket, went to the kitchen, wiped the counter with one of the germ-killing wipes he had to buy for himself. Mom came in. You working again tomorrow? She asked. You owe me 3 months' rent. He touched the back of his head and then flipped her off, but she didn't see. He didn't owe her a damn thing. He made a sandwich to take to his room. He ate the sandwich and drank some water. He felt good. Later, if he couldn't sleep, he'd go for a drive. He'd make a swing by the building where Dad's restaurant had been, before the IRS shut it down. If he didn't keep an eye on it, some homeless wino bedded down in the doorway. Sometimes Albert thought it was his old man's ghost inside that cardboard shack, under the sleeping bag that was so rotten Albert wouldn't touch it. But ghosts didn't bother him. A ghost was a nothing. Albert wasn't afraid of his old man anymore, not afraid of bitch Mom either, but when he drove around he liked to think what it would be like to have somebody in the van with him, somebody who said his name, and when they saw the wino ghost, told him, that's not you, that'll never be you. Maybe tonight when he opened the door to the van she'd be there and she'd say, where have you been? I've been waiting.
Right, Nora, so you set this up with a very complicated individual who... You hint at a past for this person that is troubling in and of itself. He doesn't have a good relationship with his mother. He hates his father. Probably something happened in his past that's not quite revealed here. He has germ-killing wipes, so he's a little eccentric.
Yes.
There, he's got a knife that he pats, and then he's a bit lonely, right?
He is very lonely.
Yeah, and so... Is that part of the trick, too, trying to give even the bad guy a little bit of something in him that you're empathize with or connect to?
I think so. I think the reader needs a reason, more reasons to keep going. And I think I hope you heighten the suspense by actually showing the humanity in the person I call the bad guy so that the reader will feel something. I've said that if I quit reading a book, if a book sits by my reading table by my chair for 3 or 4 weeks and the bookmark never moves from one place to the next, it's usually because I don't identify with any of the characters. And sometimes the character I identify with or I'm most interested in is the bad guy. So I think that as a writer, I want to show the human side, show that he has a point of view. He has a perspective on the world that is understandable, even if it's not acceptable.
Well, without a good bad guy, you can't keep throwing obstacles in the way of the protagonist,
right? That's
right.
And
you can't have that arc and all the reversals that go with a good story. Nora, before we finish up here, and I want to play a little something we've been doing in the second season here called First Draft. I asked the authors who appear on the show to make a choice, one or the other, or neither, or both. And then if you want to editorialize, you can.
Okay.
Just to find a little bit more about you as a writer. So you ready?
Yeah.
Ink, pen, or keyboard?
Both.
Both? You use both to write?
Yes. Okay. Not at the same time.
That would be Poetry or prose?
Prose.
Yeah, always been prose for you?
Yes.
Now, this one might be tough. Fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction.
Even though you wrote the nonfiction account, you're drawn to fiction.
And I read nonfiction, but I am drawn to fiction.
All right. Morning or night for writing?
Daylight.
Daylight? You like to write during the day?
Yes.
Early? Late?
I can write any time of day, but I will typically knock off by about 5 o'clock.
Outline or free flow?
Free flow.
Oh, you do?
Okay. Yes.
All right. But a mystery, you have to have a little bit of an outline, right?
I sometimes stop and outline what I have done to try to get a sense of where my subconscious is taking me. But no, you don't have to have that much of an outline.
Okay. This might be kind of a trick question because we haven't talked about the other part of your writing life. Writing or editing?
That is very difficult. I love both.
Yeah. Do you like editing your own work or the work of others better?
Others.
Others, yeah.
Though I say that and I smile as I say it because I have had to learn from my own work, I have had to learn to love rewriting. I used to hear writers say they really like to rewrite, and I thought, are they crazy? For me, the most fun part still is the first couple of drafts when you're still figuring out what the story is, and I call that the voyage of discovery. But I've had to embrace the idea that rewriting is absolutely necessary. It's where the work is. 5, 6, 7, 8 drafts are common, and you can't write it once and think you're done. You're going to have to do it again and again and again.
Yeah. I've heard this before. For the listeners, I have to reveal that Nora was my editor on the 3 books that I wrote. Did a great job, but it was one of these things. She would, you know, I would think that I'd just, you know, written this great little piece. I'd send it off. It'd come back with a lot of red, and we'd talk on the phone, and she'd say, well, what do you think? I'm like, how do you get so much red on this page?
But I do want to say, yeah, if I can learn to love the process of rewriting, then anybody can learn to love that process.
But it is true, and I will say this, that even though your first reaction is, oh, they didn't love what I just wrote, you know, that it does lead you to better quality work. And it also, what I found was, it might even lead to another idea. I know it did for me when I was working with you, because you would ask a question and I would think of something else and that would move me to it.
Right.
And so that's also the job of a good editor, I assume, is to kind of help the writer get out of their own way.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Keep the imagination open.
All right.
Don't shut it down by thinking you're done.
Right. All right. Next one. Library or Google?
Google.
Dictionary or spell check?
Both,
yeah.
But then I have the Merriam-Webster app on my computer, so.
Introvert or extrovert?
Somewhere in between.
In between, okay.
I've said that on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm probably naturally a 4, but I live at 7.
Hmm. E-reader or paper book?
E-reader.
Oh, you like the e-reader,
I
right?
do. Yeah.
Social media or personal appearances?
Both,
okay. Last question, marketing or manual labor?
Yeah. If I said manual labor, my husband would call you up and say she lied.
Yeah.
I'll have to say marketing.
Oh, wow. But there's a close call, right?
It's a close call.
All right. Okay. All right, Nora, we've got one short section here I'm going to have you read, just a couple of minutes. This introduces us to the two female protagonists, the one that's kidnapped and the one that we met in the first scene, her friend, when they're younger, when they're in boarding school together. So take it away.
Let's go have some fun, Angie said. What are you talking about? Meet you down the hall. She turned and led her gang off. Kella stopped the music, closed the book, and followed, annoyed and curious. In the bathroom, Angie stood beside a stool with newspapers spread on the floor around it. Sit here. The other girl stood to one side and watched. Why? Kella asked, but she obeyed. Kella Mace, Angie said. Take a good look at the girl in the mirror. She isn't you, not anymore. It's time for your real self to be revealed. Kella looked at herself. Her eyes were brown like Mom's. Her hair was straight and dark like Pop's. She wore it parted down the middle, shoulder length, pulled into a low ponytail. Take out the scrunchie, Angie said. Shake your hair loose. Kella did as she was told, and everyone studied her hair. Angie stepped to the mirror and taped a Xerox photo to it. Do you know who this is? You in a former life. Her name was Louise Brooks. She was in silent movies. Silent, like you. The girls giggled. The photo was black and white, but Louise Brooks glowed. Her big dark eyes were almost covered by glossy bangs. Her hair was a shiny helmet cut to her jawline, with C curls over each cheek. Her chin was curved like a doll's, her complexion creamy. "She looks just like you," one of the girls said. "No, she doesn't. Angie just makes you think that," Kella said. "That's because Angie knows the truth," Angie said. "Now hold your hair up so I can get this towel around your neck." "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to cut your hair." Kella went from looking into Louise Brooks's eyes to Angie's by way of the mirror. Angie brushed her hair straight, then switched to a comb and began to make sections and pin them up. Kella felt helpless, but also somehow hopeful, as if this was meant to be, and it was good. She convinced herself it didn't matter. Hair grows. Angie had scissors in her hand and began to snip. The girls inhaled as the first strands fell. "This haircut is called a shingle," Angie said. "I found a video how to do it. Tilt your head down." The scissors were cold against her neck. A curtain of hair fell over her face and slid to the floor. Kella sat very still. When it was over and the photo was gone, she was face to face with herself again, a new self, just as Angie had promised.
So the cover of the book, is that a shingle haircut on the cover?
Yes.
And obviously this is audio, so listeners can't see it, but that is the cover. There's a white background and hair that's cropped close on the sides to the ears, kind of almost looks like a helmet a little bit. And then the words of the book, "Worst Thing," appear sort of where the face would be. Interesting. So these are our characters. These are the ones we're going to pull for throughout the book, and the ones who, along with some other strong women, help kick some Albert butt before this
yes,
is over.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Nora, I want to thank you for joining me today to talk about your books and mystery and suspense writing. It's been a lot of fun. Tell me where people can find the book.
I am a great believer in independent bookstores, and your favorite bookstore can order the book for you, any of the three books for you. They are also available online.
Okay, great. Well, are you working on something else at the moment, or are you still taking a deep breath from the suspense you created for yourself with this book?
I have another story in mind. It is developing. I write a scene before I go to sleep. I write a scene in my mind before I go to sleep every night, and pretty soon need to start committing those scenes to paper. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say at least one of the characters from The Worst Thing is probably going to live to see another day and another story.
But you're saving some time for doing a little editing down the road,
yes,
right?
I am.
Okay,
yes, I am.
Right.
Waiting for you, Landis.
All right. Okay, good. All right, well, Nora, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. Another fine author giving voice to their written words. If you liked our show, we'd very much appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends or by leaving a review on iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, or by connecting with us on social media. Our social media links are at our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. If you sign up for our email list at our website, you'll get a free ebook, a novel written by your host. And by the way, if you do sign up for our email list, we promise not to spam you, just send you periodic updates about the show. Next week, we'll have another interesting author read and talk about their work. I hope you will join us. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.